following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
He's an American icon who fought in World War II, gave you Martin Lewis, Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Andy Williams, Fried Green Tomatoes, Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, The Declaration of Independence, People for the American Way, and a few TV shows.
Maybe you've heard of a couple of these.
All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Hot L, Baltimore, One Day at a Time, Mary Harmon, Mary Harmon, The Dumplings, All's Fair, All the Glitters, Fernwood Tonight, America Tonight, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, The Baxters, Archie Bunker's Place, Silver Spoons, Gloria, Square Pegs, a.k.a. Pablo, Who's the Boss, 227, Sunday Dinner, The Powers That Be, 704 Houser, Channel Umpteen and 3, One Day at a Time on Netflix.
All of the above with Norman Lear. It's all of the above with Norman Lear. What you do, you know that Norman Lear is just another version of you.
Hi.
Oh, hi.
Okay, so we are, we're concerned with this title, All of the Above, because we're not sure we're going to cover all of the above. But it is the attempt to cover with our guest star this week. I'm going to withhold that name for a little while so that people at home can wonder who on earth could it be that he is this excited about.
Build the suspense.
Because he is really excited, because it's an old dear friend and a brilliant, brilliant artist. And who will be here any moment, and we're awaiting her. I'll let you know the sex of this person, her arrival. All of the above with Norman Lear. I am Norman Lear, and Paul Hipp is sitting beside me.
Hi, Norman.
He's leaning on his chin, his elbow to the table. Why do you need all that information?
And it took me every day of all of my 54 years to get here to be leaning on my chin looking at you.
No kidding. It's taken me every bit of 95 years to see you do this.
And that's the magic.
I'll be a son of a gun. And the front door is opening. And truly.
Wow.
Truly, I'm raking my mind to see if I can come up with anybody else who's given me more pleasure in my lifetime. Out of family, out of a kid who lived with you for 20 years. But as a friend, nobody has given me more pleasure. The memory of thinking about her is so pleasurable. And you know, of course, I'm talking about that door is opening. It's Mary Kay Place herself.
Mary Kay Place!
Hey, hi!
Welcome!
Hey, Mary Kay.
Thank you. I can't believe I'm sitting here with you guys. This is so exciting.
Well, then it's all over. If she can't believe it, maybe it's not happening.
I'm a huge fan. This is exciting for me.
It's happening.
I'm a huge fan, too. How are you, my sweetheart?
I'm great. Thank you very much.
So what are you doing here?
Well, you invited me.
I did?
You invited me to be on your podcast several times, but it actually came through. We had a gathering to read a script the other day, and you said, would you like to be on the show Thursday on my podcast? And I went, whoa. Yes, I would.
Thursday was open. Are we all close enough to mics and all of that? So we're doing okay. When I asked that question for you out there, I was talking to two people behind a glass with a tremendous amount of equipment.
It's a professional operation we have going on.
Yes, and that's why you're hearing it. You tens of thousands on every,
millions.
Every city block in America.
Millions.
Anyway, I love your being here, Mary Kay.
Thank you for inviting me.
We go back. Now, this is my memory of us.
Okay.
My first memory of your first venture to the other side of the camera, to be on camera. It was an episode of All in the Family. You were working for somebody. I can't remember who.
I'll tell you in a moment.
And we were doing an episode in which Gloria had two friends sleeping over. And I know you were not at the time an actress, but
I was in here, Norman, way deep inside, but I hadn't revealed it.
But you hadn't revealed it, maybe even to yourself.
What were you doing there?
I'm going to tell all of this when he finishes his.
Oh, yes. Anyway, so I said, why don't you come up and be one of Gloria's friends? And you did. And that, I think, was your first time on in front of a camera. Am I correct?
Almost my first time, but it was certainly my big featured first time. And here's what I remember, which is exactly that, but with a few extra details. So I came from Oklahoma in my Volkswagen after I graduated from college, asked my father how to get to the Turner Turnpike. His face went ashen, and I got in the car with my girlfriend, and we drove across country, came to L.A. I got a job as a clerk typist at CBS in the music clearance department, where I learned about music publishing, which really served me well later.
Yeah.
And then I was a receptionist on the third floor at CBS, where all the Carol Burnett show, Norman show, all the production offices were. Tim Conway saw me the second day on the job trying to manage all the phone calls, said, "Would you be my secretary?" I said, "I've never been a secretary before." He said, "I've never had one before." And so I went, "Well, okay then." So I worked for his 13-episode summer, the Tim Conway Comedy Hour, learned so much. Was in every note session with the writers that Barry Levinson and Rudy DeLuca and Craig T. Nelson were writers back then on the show, and would perform comedy skits as well. And then I got a job, and then that show got canceled. And eventually, I was a dog in a children's. I went, got in a dog suit, and was quote co-producer and the on-camera dog in a children's show. At a local TV station in L.A., waiting for this job, which I then got on Maude. And it was the first season of Maude, the second season, I believe, of All in the Family. It was the spinoff. And I was the, quote, secretary once again, not remotely knew how to be a secretary, for Bob Schiller and Bob Weisskopf, who were the head writers of Maude, who had written for I Love Lucy and all these amazing comedy shows throughout the television history. And it was an unbelievable job. It was so exciting and thrilling to work in that office with Norman and All in the Family and Maude. We were all there together. And I learned, it was like graduate school. It was a 24/7 job. And I was writing stuff. I had always been in plays in school and variety shows and all that and loved it, but I was interested in writing and just the whole package. I didn't know where I would end up, but all of it fascinated me, and I was thrilled to be in this process with these shows of understanding how everything was developed and how it got to the eventual camera-ready script. So I was writing material. This was in the early 70s. And the Miss America pageants always had some quite humorous talent entries. And one of them, this girl would have an original oration for her talent on democracy versus communism. So then I wrote a song called "If Communism Comes Knocking at Your Door, Don't Answer It." And I taught it to my girlfriend, who was a really good singer that I'd worked with at the local LA station, and we harmonized on it, had a little glass of wine at lunch, which you did back in those days on a weekday, mm-hmm. on a work day. And we were singing it at the top of our lungs, walking from the farmer's daughter across the street from CBS to up to the office. And Bernie and the head writers of All in the Family heard it. And they said, "Has Norman heard that song?" And I said, "I didn't know you'd heard it." And they said, "Oh, we're going to tell Norman about that." So 10 minutes later, back up in the office, Norman says, "Will you sing that song?" And my friend was still there. And my mouth went totally dry. And I was shaking like a leaf. And I said, "Okay." And we sang it. And he said, "Would you like to be on All in the Family and sing that song?" Now, can you imagine?
No.
You're a secretary in the office. You have a glass of wine, you sing a song in the parking lot, and you end up on the number one rated show, All in the Family.
That's amazing.
Did you sing the song on the show?
Yes, and you published it.
Oh, for crying out loud.
And what?
Tell me the context of how did we get to a song?
I think you wrote suddenly you wrote, I don't know that those two girls were going to be spending the night until you heard the song. And then you figured out a way to shoehorn us into the episode.
Do you remember the lyric?
Are you kidding? Of course I remember it.
Oh, please.
Oh, Lord.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mary Kay Place, remembering something that took place a little while ago.
40 years ago.
1973 or two
something
or something like that.
That's amazing.
God, that's 18 and 28. That's 46 years. Yeah? Is that 36 years.
And I didn't warm up my voice this morning, and I'm going to have to start really low. That was a good start. If communism comes a-knocking at your door, don't answer it. If communism comes a-knocking at your neighbor's door, don't let him answer it. For democracy's the way to live each and every day. So if communism comes, just say you're not at home. Whoa, whoa, whoa. From democracy we'll never, ever roam.
That's awesome.
And for that, ladies and gentlemen, I got a one-way ticket.
To the top.
To All in the Family. I know it's hard to understand, but it happened.
So one of Gloria's friends, you, sang that song.
And my friend Patty, who sang it in that office that afternoon, you invited her as well.
Yes, so the two of you.
And it was the greatest gift and champion. What was it? So happy that's not me.
But no, I thought I turned it off.
But you never turn it off.
Coming!
This happens on some episodes.
Lynn?
One time it was Ed Asner.
Hi, sweetheart.
So where are you? You're not doing your podcast, are you?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Lynn.
And you're on the air. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi, the lady's voice.
God,
that
I can't believe it.
The lady's voice you heard is Mary Kay Place.
Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi.
How are you? I can't believe I did this again.
You're a recurring character.
Oh, my God. I'm so
But,
nervous.
Maybe the world will be interested in what you called about.
No, it was just about Kate Lear. We just had the sweetest discussion. But anyway,
yes.
We can talk about it.
Kate Lear is, for those who may not know, is my daughter, Kate Lear LaPook, married to John LaPook, and she is visiting from New York.
Oh, that's great.
And if this is extremely intimate, let's share it.
Oh, honey, no, I'm actually gotta go get ready now. But Mary Kay, I love you.
Love you.
You're having a great conversation.
You're the reason I was wearing a shirt and tie. I'll see you later.
Okay, sweetheart.
Bye.
Okay.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye. Bye. That is hilarious.
Oh, my goodness.
Was your friend on the show, too?
My friend was on the show, too, Patty Weaver. And it was one of the all-time great gifts. I mean, it was in the L.A. Times, this crazy story about us singing the song. It was just amazing. And then later, he gave me the gift of song again when I played Loretta Haggers on Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman.
Yeah.
And got to write all these hilarious, well, I thought they were hilarious. I don't know if other people did. Either the lyrics were in the script and I made up the music, or I wrote the lyrics and the music to all of Loretta's crazy songs, and that was so fun.
And she was living with her husband, who she called, wait a minute. She called Baby Boy.
My big old baby boy.
My big old baby boy. Graham Jarvis was the actor's name. He was, God, what a lovely actor. And a lovely man, my baby boy. Is there any difference between the sound of you talking here today and Loretta Haggers?
Yes. I think there's quite a difference. I certainly hope so.
Yeah. Where did that come from, though?
Well, answer. Talk about Loretta's style for a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, Loretta, in my mind, when I wrote The Girl Who Had the Original Oration on Democracy versus Communism, she was not Loretta by any stretch, but she could have been a cousin of Loretta's.
Uh-huh.
My parents were from Texas. My father grew up in a small town in West Texas. There were a lot of Loretta-like folks. I have a 99. She's the only living elder in our family, cousin, second cousin named Mary. We were both named after my father's mother, who is hilarious. But she's very different from Loretta, but she has a very strong Texas accent. And so I was always working on a character that spoke like those people that I knew, that I loved in my grandmother's town. And, you know, I was first offered the part of Kathy, Mary Hartman's sister. And I saw, and they gave me the script, and I saw Loretta in there singing a song, and I said, oh, no, I have to be Loretta. Loretta is the girl for me.
Wow. And you had a whole singing career from that, right? You made some records.
Well, I don't know if I'd call it a career, but I had 3 albums for Columbia Records, and it was thrilling beyond belief because I met so many incredible musicians who were all fans of the show, who wanted to be on, you know, play, and they were, you know, really serious, big-time studio musicians. And Emmy Lou Harris and her, well, they weren't married then, but her eventual husband produced 2 of the albums, and Rob Fraboni produced the 3rd one, which was somewhat of a departure. But it was a terrifyingly frightening because I didn't have all my musical homework done by a long shot, and thrilling beyond belief. And I decided when I actually accepted, because several record companies had offered me recording things because of the success of Mary Hartman, obviously. That's the only reason. And I was afraid they would be, you know, Laverne and Shirley sing the 50s hits.
Let yourself slide into speak Loretta Haggar style.
I said, I'm going to do this because I don't want to be in my bed with my teeth in a glass in a jar by the bed and think I didn't take advantage of this fantastic opportunity. So I just said, I'm not going to have any regrets in my life. If I fail, if I'm horrible, I'm just going to go ahead and do it.
Well, that's amazing because they're great.
I love it.
They're great.
You know, here's a line. I don't know if you know what I'm going to say.
I do know what you're going to say. I'm pretty sure, but let's see.
It comes to me. I might have said it to you over a cigar or something. We are in the habit of having a smoke now and again of a Cuban cigar.
Yeah.
I heard that on one of the shows, but you know what my favorite habit is that I heard that you have?
What's that?
That you sing songs together.
Oh, yeah.
And joyously sing for hours with a group of people.
The guys that come over, we have dinner and wine. They all play instruments. And everybody but me plays an instrument. With 10, 11 of us sit outside over a Cuban cigar and 500 songs.
And sing your guts out. There is nothing more fun.
Till 1, 2 o'clock in the
morning. Nothing more fun on the planet.
Yes, this is true.
Well, if you smoke a cigar, we'll have you join us.
I don't smoke a cigar, but I would like to eavesdrop.
She would like to what?
Eavesdrop.
Eavesdrop.
But you
arrange that.
And shake a tambourine or do something.
That qualifies.
Sing a little harmony part or something.
So what I was going to say was an episode of Mary Hartman where her husband, Big Daddy, Daddy Boy.
No, Big Old Baby Boy.
Big Old Baby Boy. Arranged for her as a budding young singer to get on the Dinah Shore Show. And she was on the Dinah Shore. Dinah came and played on Mary Hartman.
Oh, cool.
So we were doing the Dinah Shore show with the real Dinah Shore. And she introduces Loretta Haggar, who was going to sing a song, but they were going to talk first, as happened on the Dinah Shore show. There are 2 chairs there, and the camera's on Dinah. She introduces Loretta Haggar, who walks into the picture, sits in the chair next to Mary. Dinah says, welcome. I hope you're having a good time. She says something to the effect that she's having a wonderful time. And everybody's so kind and nice to her, all the crew and everything. And Dinah says, yes, they're very special. And Loretta Hager says, and I understand so many of them is Jewish. And Dinah blanches, of course. She doesn't know what's coming next. And then Loretta Hager says, you know, I cannot believe that they was the people what killed our Lord. And that line, that moment, that Loretta Hager's, that character, that arc, that... I always talk about laughter adding time to your life. I know that has added some weeks, some months, whatever, to my life. Because I think about it 35 to 80 times a year. And delight, God, I cannot believe that they was the people what killed our Lord.
Bless her heart.
It's good to bring out those old saws that were used to hurt and to harm and can be thought of laughably now.
But in Loretta's case, it was not used to hurt.
No,
Loretta's oblivious. She has no idea. She's genuinely sincere.
Yeah,
because she,
yeah, no, this
she,
is,
has
she
no,
learned this she, growing up.
She learned it growing up. It's like that Rodgers and Hammerstein, you've got to be carefully taught, and you're oblivious to it. You don't know any different. She
you've
didn't even know what she was saying.
This is that song. Oh, I love you for referring to that. We're the same person. You've got to be taught to
carefully
be afraid.
Taught,
you've
yes.
got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made
yes.
and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught.
You did that with a lot of your shows, though. I mean, that kind of thing through humor brought out those, I mean, Archie Bunker, all of it. I mean, no one was doing that before you.
Well, but there was some context. It was the show. This reference I just made to the one line. But I love that moment when this person, as you mentioned, had been carefully taught when she was very young, these later to be understood as obscene, ridiculous things.
Right.
Oh, my God.
And somebody who was just kind and nice, it wouldn't have had a bad word to say about anybody.
No,
just
oblivious to what she's saying.
Yeah.
Totally has not a clue.
Yeah, and just where she's from.
So what was your family like?
My parents, as I said earlier, were both from Texas. They were probably, I think, the first people in their families that went to college. My father's father was a farmer and a musician. My mother's father worked at the Gulf Refinery on the docks. My parents met in college. They fell in love in college. They were married for over 60 years plus when my mother passed away first, my father at 94, in 2015 and my, or 16 and my,
and your mom?
My mom was 81. My father was 94. My grandmother was 96. My father was a college professor at the University of Tulsa. He was a graphic arts professor, and he was the head of the art department, and he loved people so much. He loved his students. My father is what I think it's Gladstone calls a connector. He loved having people meet each other and connecting up. He found jobs for all of his art students. He connected them up with local people or you know, the card company in Kansas City, Hallmark Cards, for design. And he was just a big people person. My mother was an elementary school teacher. She would take the child that was the worst kid in everybody else's class and was going to be the worst kid in her class, and she would buddy up with him and say, all right, I'm going to give you some special assignments. She gave him a lot of attention, that child. and I'm saying him because it was usually a boy, and she would, they would behave differently in her class. I think my mother had some kind of natural psychological insight. Mm. She never was in therapy. She never probably took a psychology course in her life or understood it, but she had some kind of intuitive understanding, I think, of people. Not that she was fully conscious, and my father was totally unconscious in many ways. Because, like I said, they never went to therapy. They never came to consciousness in that way. But there was, and there was a lot of humor in our family. We had tons of dysfunction as well. A whole, you know, ocean fulls. But there was love, and there was a lot of laughter.
Were you into your career before they passed?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, my dad was completely proud as a peacock.
Uh-huh.
There was a lot, there was teasing, there was harassment, there was the whole package, but there was a lot of really, funny storytelling and laughter. And my father was a hilarious storyteller. If he told a joke and it was a corny setup, payoff joke, you know, like a written joke, it was horrible, and he would tell horrible. They weren't even funny. I said, "Daddy, don't even tell those stories. They're a waste of your time. Tell a real story." But if he told a story of an incident in his life,
it was funny because he was telling it.
And he just every detail that he gave, and the voices, and we always listened to, what's his name?
Prairie Home Companion.
No. Old. Who's the comedian that was a painter and was also kind of insane?
Jonathan Winters.
We had all the Jonathan Winters records.
Yeah, they were great.
But real things would happen in our family when he got the houseboat and couldn't drive it and was backing into other people's boats. And all these things he would tell, I'm telling you, I would scream. We'd all scream laughing. He was so funny. And my grandfather, his father, was funny. My grandmother was funny on that side. And I had two brothers, an older brother and a younger brother, and we all tortured each other. And we're all very close now.
Oh, that's great.
And we were close then, but it was the boys against me. You know, we all just, and it was hard.
Have you been married?
I have never been married, Norman.
How did you avoid that?
Because
how did you manage to avoid?
Because I honestly do not think I've ever really met my mate. I've had crushes on people. I've loved people. But when it came down to, was it like my parents' marriage? Because I think my parents were true companions. They were best friends. They fought all the time, but it didn't mean a thing. They could each be who they were, and the other, there was always some kind of power thing, but one was good at this, one was good at that. And in the end, it didn't matter. It blew away 3 seconds later, and there was never any residual intensity or heaviness in the air. It was over, and that was it, and we started all over again. And I just thought, this isn't what my parents had. Do I think I'll be married to this person for the rest of my life? Nope. I believe in past lives. I think I've screwed up a lot. One time I smoked this joint that Willie Nelson had given me that I had put in a drawer, and he had very strong pot. This is back in the days in the 70s when I actually smoked pot. And I was getting ready to do an album, and I had made a long tape of all these female singers, you know, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Nancy Wilson, everybody you can think of from the standards period. Mm-hmm. And I was going to listen to their phrasing, their styling, just everything about them. And I started smoking this joint, which I went, oh, look, I forgot about this. And I went to the darkest place. I mean, I went to the moon and back. And I was in the restroom, and I looked like this hardened woman. I didn't even recognize myself in the mirror. And I said, you screwed up and OD'd once before. Are you going to do it again? And I wasn't even into drugs really that much. I only smoked pot. I didn't really do anything else. I never did LSD because I heard these records in my college radio station of people having trips that went from good to bad. And I thought, if there's even a chance of that, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
I felt like I'd done that before in another lifetime, but I had this sense of a previous lifetime. And then I started having a joke. I think I had 6 children and a very needy husband in another lifetime. And I just wanted to have a creative time, find my voice, see what it would be like to focus on that. And I don't know how good I would have been at one or the other. It's taken everything in me to even learn what I know now. I'm just starting to get really good clues about how all this works, the creative process. And
you're thinking a great deal lately from some things you said earlier when we were talking. You're thinking a good deal spiritually.
Yes. And I've had many spiritual episodes in my life and then dry periods where I didn't, but it sustains me. There's no question.
And what are you reading now?
I'm reading
in that arena.
Well, I always love to read my Marion Woodman Jungian books about the archetypal feminine and the imbalance in the earth and how that's developing and emerging as we continue to become conscious as a culture. And Jung's thoughts about the divine feminine or the archetypal feminine, which the men and women both have. And then I like Richard Rohr right now, but I listen to On Being, which is another podcast, which has many, they have physicists, they have civil rights workers, preachers. Richard Rohr was on there. I sent you a link about Abraham Joshua Heschel. Which I was riveted by and very moved by. So there's many things. I'm interested in centering prayer, mindful meditation, which I really started a practice of, which has helped me so much.
Mindful meditation, is that different?
Buddhist. It's Buddhist. It's like centering prayer. They're very different, but one is towards God and one is towards just spaciousness.
One being Buddhism and the other being
Christianity or religious prayer.
Yeah, so that's towards God, and then what you're doing is towards spaciousness.
Well, I do both.
Consciousness.
I go back and forth because they each provide something needed sometimes, but they also meld together at times.
Is this silent meditation? Are you using a mantra, or are you?
I don't use a mantra. I use I've been to begin this practice again, which I did years ago, then dropped it, you know, but now I've sort of made a commitment. But when I first started doing it again, there are free guided mindful meditations online, and I found them, the structure of them, very helpful to get me into that practice.
Have you tried any apps? There's Headspace. Have you heard
of
this?
I've tried and it's a good one, but that man's voice annoyed me after a while.
Yeah. He's pretty good. Some of them, though, I always find they get a little bit annoying.
Well, the good thing about...
You just want the guy to shut up so you can meditate.
Yes. And those ones I never use again. But there are so many options online, and some just move me and really speak to me. And then sometimes I just do it by myself.
Yeah.
But I start off with that, and then I click it off and go into my own. But this whole idea that I really believe now and can see in my life that we're so overloaded with stimulation and choices and things in the outer world.
Yeah.
I mean, more than ever before.
I think about that a lot.
It's remarkable.
And I personally am sensitively wired in a way that I get really overwhelmed with sensory input.
Hmm.
And I realized this is, and also then I read all the medical evidence about literally it can change the cellular structure of your brain, that we need inner silence. We need space with no thought. And also what I'm reading is that, and know it to be true in my acting work, that the unconscious gives us surprises that the intellect has nothing to do with.
Mm.
And I've experienced it again and again in my work, and working with dreams and images from dreams and whatever. And who doesn't want to be surprised?
Yeah.
I mean, this is what we live for, to be surprised and genuinely surprised. And Richard Rohr says, and then I see Heschel said the same thing. I mean, once you start reading about it, you see for a long time people have been saying these things, that without an interior life and going into that silence, you can't move into the deeper realms of mystery, which the intellect and the rational mind knows nothing about.
Yeah, the mind-made self. It's all noise, and you get quiet, and then the good stuff starts to come through, basically.
How did you just express it, the inner...
Just having an inner experience.
An inner experience.
With the unconscious, which is the divine realm or the unconscious.
I'm just wondering if we can have and articulate an inner experience for people who are listening. How do you sit down?
I would recommend, I could not do it because I'm not trained in it, and I wouldn't be so arrogant as to think that I could at this moment as a beginning student in all of this. But they could go to the Mindful Meditation websites. There's one at UC San Diego, Boston University, UCLA. Inside LA in Santa Monica is a mindful-based institute, and get proper instructions and hear about it, read about it, and then experience it. Just trying one of, there's 5-minute, 10-minute, 20-minute, 45-minute guided meditation.
Guided.
Yeah.
Have you ever taken one?
I meditate every day.
Do you with a guided, or you do it yourself?
I do a couple of things. I do sort of mantra based mm-hmm. meditation,
transcendental.
Yeah, like that, except without paying the thousands and thousands of dollars that they now ask for. To me, it's to get to be mindful, to get to that place where the thoughts that are just constantly barraging. Here's what's amazing to me. If I do a 20-minute meditation, when I close my eyes and I go with the mantra is that it will take you to a place of non-thinking, because you can only focus on one thing. So it tends to be a word that doesn't mean anything, a nonsense syllable. So it has no meaning, no color, no thing that you can picture. And it just takes you out to this place where you're now in this place. And then the thoughts come and you acknowledge them and then let the thoughts go and go back to that place. A friend of mine described it as you're standing on an overpass over the 405, and it could be, maybe it's rush hour, and there's a billion cars down there, and they're all beeping. Those are the thoughts. And I'm standing on this rush hour. And they said it could be 3 in the morning, and there's one car's coming every now and then. And these are thoughts. He said, it doesn't matter what time it is. Just don't grab onto the bumper of any of them, and get dragged down the street. So
yeah.
What happens to me that's always amazing, this goes to your thing about how we're barraged with stuff and how it then gets mixed up in my mind, is when I sit down to do my meditation, I'm always amazed at how I am when I start and then what I feel like at the end. I always take notice of what I feel like at the end. When I start, my mind is so noisy. It's just so many things going on. They have nothing to do with anything. And as I go through the meditation, things calm down, the seas calm down, the waters calm down. And by the end, not every day perfectly, but pretty much every time by the end, the waters are calm. And then I can go back on with my day and bring this stuff into my daily interactions with people, or as I'm driving,
Does that reflect your experience too, Mary?
Yes, Shane? There's different elements, but it's the same basic thing, and it's so helpful.
It's so helpful because this mind-made self doesn't serve me. It's literally just, there's so much shit coming in. Whether it's the news, where barrage news, we talked about how I made a decision on election day. I'm putting this down. I'm not looking at 24-hour news. I can stay. What I used to do 20 years ago, before all this barrage of news, you could read a newspaper and be very well informed. My mm-hmm. parents read the Philadelphia Inquirer, and they were very well informed, and they watched Cronkite. They didn't watch, MSNBC and then check their website and then check Twitter and then check, So I decided to do that and focus on other things. And one of them is meditation. The other things are like getting back to rudiments on things I love to do, play music, painting, all that stuff. And I tell you, it's a much better way to exist for me. But meditation is key, you know. And I do like that headspace. I'm very cynical about, not cynical, but guided meditations, because they tend to get a little bit hippie kind of, you know, woo-woo for me. But that guy's
so
good.
There's so many choices. And there's a lot of good ones. I'm with you.
Lot.
I don't like gooey, icky,
no,
cinnamon, you know, or somebody who has an annoying...
Or an agenda.
There's plenty of annoying ones.
Yeah, yes.
But the ones at there's a lot of good ones, too.
Oh, I want to get some addresses from you. Yeah.
Give me some links.
Yeah, but I think, and a lot of people, you know, like these apps, like Headspace, which you hear about it a lot, and it's one of the great things in this phone does have, besides taking pictures and all, but besides all the things that distract us and all the bad things, these meditation apps are really catching fire. They're becoming very popular, and you hear more and more about this mindfulness stuff. You know,
Richard Rohr says because he says you can't get anywhere today without contemplation, without this meditational silence, to get to a deeper meaning of life and what we're doing here. He talks about the two halves of life. The first half, where we're wanting to be successful and we need outward verification that we've made it, whatever. But the second half is where you explore the inner life and you realize it's not all about the outward stuff. It's like, what's going on without all of that?
He has to be, this third voice, me, doesn't meditate, has tried to meditate unsuccessfully. And when I say that, I don't mean to imply that I tried hard. I've tried over the years. It's important to me when I'm listening. I love to hear about it. But it's never been important to me to go there.
Mm.
So I half-heartedly tried.
When you don't half-heartedly try, you might have a different experience. I'm just throwing that out there. I'm saying if you aren't that interested in it.
Don't do it.
Well, I'm just saying it may not be effective.
You may have been.
I understand. I'm not blaming meditation or. You know.
May just be the master, and you don't need it.
That's right, because you're Mr. Titanium.
Yes,
he's made of titanium.
Titanium.
He's the strongest. I've never known anybody who could do as many things in a day, one after the other, and not be stressed out, not show any ill effects from it, not be overstimulated, overwhelmed over anything, just.
I've thought of that where Norman's concerned, too, because, you know, if I have to do the podcast at 3:30, I wake up and I just wait for 3:30 to come because that's all I can fucking think about. And then when this is done, I'll be wiped out. Norman has already, when we get here, he's 95, he's already done, worked out, he's done this, he's had a meeting, then he had a lunch with somebody, then he went somewhere else and he shows up wearing a suit because he's got to be at an event later tonight to present an award.
At the last minute, presenting an award to somebody.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. And that's what you were like ever since I've known you. You were full on scheduled every second of the day, and I don't know how you've done it all these years.
How do you do it?
That's right. See, some people don't need it.
You know, we're fucking up. Mindfulness maybe is for the birds.
Who was I talking to? I was eating a salad a few hours ago, lunchtime. And Paul
Slansky
was in the office with me. And we were talking about I don't know what, but suddenly he said, you know, I got to say, you really enjoy, I love the way you enjoy what you're eating. And I was surprised by it. And I said, well, I love it. I mean, if I didn't love it, I wouldn't be eating it. But don't you have three meals a day? He said, yeah. He said, but I don't think I get what you get out of it.
That's so great. I love that.
And I said, well, it might surprise you, but I not only am enjoying this, but it reminds me of dinner later. And I enjoy thinking about dinner later as I'm eating lunch now.
Over and next.
Yes. And my...
But that's mindful when you eat and taste your food and enjoy it.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
That's mindful eating. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's being in the moment, because it's really about being in the present moment. And I spend a lot of time thinking about what's already happened or what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And not enough
time. I talk about that a lot in these terms.
Yeah.
Two little words we don't give enough importance to. Over and next.
Yeah.
When something's over, over.
Yes.
We're on to next.
Yes.
But if there was a hammock in the middle of over and next, that would be what they mean by living in the moment.
Yes.
That's the best definition I know.
That's
that
great.
Moment between over
yeah, great.
And next.
I heard a good bookend for that. So what, yes. Now what? A friend of mine said to me.
So what?
So what, now what?
Now what? That's good.
So what, now what? Something's going on. Oh, the sky's falling. So what, now what?
Well, now what?
Now we
well, what should we do with this time we've had? It's a loaf.
We could sing a song.
I want you all to sing a song.
Well, you know, I know a song. Check this song out. Do you know this song? Wait a minute. Let me get this guitar.
Uh-oh. Paul Hipp brings a guitar because he plays a wonderful guitar. He sings and writes songs.
I know.
That is Mr. Hipp.
Close enough. Hey, do you know this song? I even brought lyric sheets in case you need a reminder. I got a real important job in a large office building, riding people on an elevator. I drive a 57 Chevrolet with busted taillights, burned out valves, and a leaky radiator. I wear a $20 suit I bought from J.C. Penney's back in 1962. But I've got something to brag about, something to brag about, something to brag about in you.
Are you gonna do a modulation? I'm a short order cook in an all-night cafe down on 18th Avenue and 12th Street. I wear a swinging mini dress that I made for myself from mama's kitten curtains and old bed sheets. I got 17 pages of top value stamps and one old pair of shoes. But I got something to brag about, something to brag about, something to brag about in you. When you're with the fellas, I know you start a bragging about my hourglass figure and my big brown eyes.
You keep telling your girlfriend about my sweet, sweet loving, and that's one thing that money can buy.
So let's
get married in the not too distant future. We'll rent a little flat on 29th Street. You know we'll hang our washing on the clothesline from the windows. We'll feast on cornbread, butter beans, and lunch meat. We won't have a thermostat, big long Cadillac, but we'll have a love that's true. And I'll have something to brag about.
Yeah, and I'll have something to brag about.
Something to brag about in you.
Good land of the living. Why did you not tell me so I could have warmed my voice up and done a little homework on this song?
I almost had a heart attack. Let me ask you something. The people for whom this song, I mean, you picked up this song, you knew it, Mary Kay, the
since
minute you heard the
from
first.
From 1976.
She did.
From 1976.
I haven't sung it since 1976.
And the audience for that song, the specific audience for that song is known to you.
Well, Willie Nelson was the other voice on that song. It's an old song that I think was...
George Jones and Conway
yeah,
Twitty.
Yeah, George
Jones. I mean, George Jones and
Loretta.
And Loretta yeah.
No.
George Jones and...
So what slice...
Tammy Wynette.
Tammy Sue Wynette.
What slice of the American audience... How big a slice of the American audience was Willie Nelson?
Big. He was a crossover artist and still is. Not just the country audience, but he had hipsters. He had my parents' generation. he had a wide cross section, the same cross section that Mary Hartman had. I used to call it the crossover show because it was intellectually a crossover. It was geographically a crossover. Willie had him and still has many, many fans from all different walks of life.
He's really unique that way, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
Rock and roller, love him, country music, like, all ages.
All ages, because he did the standards albums with all the big standards.
Yeah.
And, but Willie sang that song, and it was a very popular country song much earlier, but then we had the Willie group listening and the Mary Hartman group listening.
Your version of that is so great.
It was fun, but I...
So great.
It was really fun to do, yeah.
And that was a hit for you, wasn't it?
I think it got played a lot on country music stations. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that.
I love listening to the two of them. It's wonderful. The question that was looming in my head from behind the question I just asked was, is his audience, I guess in asking the question, I'm thinking the audience, when I say his audience, is a smaller slice of the American audience than it really was. And because behind that, the question was, who is serving them today?
Well, country music has changed quite a bit because it's more pop-oriented right now.
Tom Petty called it bad rock bands with a fiddle.
Well, there are good artists that still rise to the surface, but the whole tone of country radio is more pop-oriented. There's still songs that I will hear on country radio that if it's 8 o'clock in the morning, I could burst into tears, but they're most generally not the pop version ones. But country radio is still very big. Country music is still, it's one of the few genres of music still making money.
I was going to say that they actually buy their music. They're the last folks that actually buy their music. Country music.
Country music.
Yeah.
But there, you know, there's stations that play all the old stuff. I mean, it's still very popular. And it's good. There's a lot of good country music. A lot of good country music.
I love country. I just still listen to the old stuff, though. I grew up outside of Philadelphia. My dad, who grew up in the city in a tough neighborhood, he heard country music just by accident, flipping around the dials when he was a little kid. And they didn't know country music in Philadelphia. They didn't have it. You know what I mean?
That's so interesting.
And he stumbled and he heard Lefty Frizzell.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, here's this kid alone in his room in the inner city, and he hears this sound, and he just couldn't get enough of it. So he kept it a secret. He wouldn't dare tell his friends because, you know, they would, what do you listen? And he would go home. Instead of playing baseball, he would have to go home. So we could listen to this radio, Sally Star on the radio once a week. So when I grew up, my dad would listen to this country music that I wouldn't hear anywhere else. Hank Williams, Jerry Lee Lewis's country stuff, Ray Charles country stuff. And
Johnny Cash, probably.
Johnny, I love that stuff, man. Yeah, and Johnny Cash. Did you ever meet Johnny Cash?
Yes.
I did too.
Many times.
What a great guy.
And I know Roseanne, his daughter, who's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. But I love country music. And now it's good, but a lot of it sounds like just a big, glossy toothpaste commercial kind of thing. And there are great artists, like you said, but like everything else now, I guess you got to really seek it out.
Well, within that world, there are still songs, like I say, that I can hear on the radio that are so simple about a certain simple kind of, like the house that Mama built.
Yeah.
That just they're so moving to me because they just talk.
Sing that.
I don't know it well enough. I don't. But I wish I could play it right now. There's some really great music around in all genres. But I don't listen to normal pop radio.
No.
Very much. But through Spotify, which some people don't like because they don't pay the artists enough, but I am introduced because everything is out there. This whole palette is out there, and they put stuff, they give you, you know, weekly playlist, and I discover all these songs I never would ever come across that have been around forever.
Yeah, that's what I do. It's
and
magic.
It blows my mind. Yeah. I get in the kitchen and I will turn on this and I'll start dancing and cooking and singing. I could do that for 3 hours and have the biggest time of my life.
Yeah. No, Spotify, I both...
I'd love to have a camera on your kitchen that's watching you do that.
Oh, I get carried away. I might have a glass or two of wine while I'm doing it.
A little mindful wine.
A little mindful wine. But no, I have a blast in that kitchen. And sometimes I have friends that have been over for dinner and we dance in the kitchen, and other times we just sing or play guitar and sing. And
I do that, but it's going to sound like I'm saying it for the moment, but I really do. But I will sing and dance as I undress, and I love doing it nude in a full-length mirror.
Fantastic.
And laughing.
I love that.
Because I can't look at myself and not laugh.
Didn't you say once that how do you know that doesn't add years to your life, right?
Oh yeah, and I thought that maybe that's the secret of longevity.
Yes, dancing nude and laughing. I agree. Yeah. I agree.
Now you were in one of the great films this year, Downsizing.
Yes, I was. I loved Land's End customer online.
Downsizing. I don't know.
I loved that movie.
I liked it, too.
I thought it was great.
I did, too.
The fish movie, the fish sex movie won the big prize, right?
Right.
It was like a children's movie with fish sex. That's nice. But I thought Downsizing was phenomenal.
I did, too.
You're great.
I liked a lot of movies.
I'm making a mental note now to... I'll find it on...
Yeah,
Alexander Payne's movie.
You probably have the screener.
Matt Damon.
Yeah,
somewhere.
Oh, I don't have the screener. No.
Don't you get all this crap?
I do, but it isn't like we save you because you get 100 of
thousand of them.
But you do. See, I got a Screen Actors Guild. We get like 8.
I get 100 thousand because I belong to DGA, WGA, and the Academy, and after SAG after.
Well, but having belonged to all of those organizations and lived the life you've lived and sat here for over an hour, as we come to the end of our time, what would you like most to have this audience know?
Let's love each other and be kind to each other and forgive each other. It's the most important thing. It is to be human, I think, is to try and do those things as much as possible.
Is there, deep in you, is there a religion that comes with that, or is that the religion?
I think both and. I'm trying to do both and now, not either or.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause I think that is in itself all a religion needs to be. If you can manage to love everybody for their humanity and accept that's what we have in common, our common humanity.
Yes, I agree.
Isn't that big enough to be an overwhelming religion?
But some people have said certain things that inspire us and help us, give us tools in order to do that because we're human, I think it's hard.
Leave us with one of those quotes from one of those people. Each man is my superior in that I may learn from him.
Fantastic.
That's a simple one. It isn't a big philosophy, but I love that.
Yes.
And here's what it reminds me of. I don't know. Stop me if I've told this story. I flew in World War II. I was a radio operator gunner on a B-17. The tour of duty ended. I had flown 52 missions, dropped bombs 35 times, and I wanted to stay over to fly men and supplies, so I saw a little more of the world in the Western theater, European theater of war. So I volunteered to fly for a month or something, just men and supplies about. I got to Cairo. And wait a minute, is this the story I wanted to tell?
I like it so far, though.
I do, too.
Cairo.
What were you talking about?
You wanted to see a little more
of the world, and you stayed on a little bit longer.
And the quote that you said, each man is my superior.
And I may learn from him.
But I
went back to World War II because I wanted to tell.
Don't cut this out.
A story. Something I learned that was so.
That had to do with that quote.
That had to do.
So you flew 52 missions, and now it's after the war.
I didn't want to talk about myself that way. I wanted to get to this, but
it's after the war. You wanted to stay.
No, you stayed an extra mission.
You wanted to stay.
I stayed to fly men and supplies. Oh, each man is my and so I got to Cairo, mm-hmm. and the pyramids, and I'm with my crew, 8 or 9 guys. And we're at a pyramid, and it costs, you know, 60 cents or whatever the hell it costs to go in the pyramid with a guide and hear all about. So we made the arrangements to do that, and I just overheard a guy holding a camel, which he was holding. So you got on his camel, they took a picture, and he took a dime from you or something. That's what he was. That was his business. But I heard him say something in English, and I turned to him, and he spoke a little English. Point of the story: the guys went in to hear about how many bricks were in the pyramid, and how long it took a laborer to, and how many slaves, whatever the information was about the pyramid. And I stood there with the camel guy talking a little bit about life with him as he put together words to make himself understood, which he did. And that's what I think about when each man is my superior comes. There was something to learn from this guy.
Fantastic.
That was more important to me than how many bricks.
Yes,
made.
Yes. You had an actual experience with a person there. As opposed to...
I love that.
That would be part of my religion, to experience human beings as they are, to learn from people. Yeah.
I think that's worthy. I love you, Mary Kay Place.
I love you, Norman Lear and Paul.
I love both of you.
I love both of you, too. And this audience, this vast audience, we don't know whether we have 740 people or 61.
Million
or 3,000 or 33,000.
How many we have?
Whoever's listening, tweet about our show. There you go, and then we'll grow.
Yeah. See that we grow.
And God,
but I've loved it. I've loved this. I wouldn't change anything. Mary Kay, to be continued.
To be continued.
What does it mean, this life, this day and night?
So I'm Norman Lear, and you can find me, should you wish to hunt me down, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Norman Lear.
And you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Gibb.
And life is good, and space and time. Give me some of yours, I'll give you some of mine.
This week on Make Spidey Famous Again, Spencer and Heidi sit down with Sheena Shea.
It was a group of us, but he's adorable. He's like, it's okay, I like older women. And I'm like, honey, I like older men. So we're not really on the same page here.
Download new episodes of Make Spidey Famous Again every Wednesday and Shenanigans with Sheena Shea every Tuesday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts. Make sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts.